Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. Super producer Casey Pegram, could you play us in with a little bit of a Wild Westy music vibe? I don't know whether we can get Ennio Morricone for this, but a sound-alike maybe? Oh, there it is. Perfect. I'm Ben.
I'm Noel. Yeah, it's just good enough that we're not going to have to pay a bunch of money for it.
That's the plan. We're hoping to recreate the experience of being in the Wild West or watching a spaghetti western without getting sued.
Did you watch that Mandalorian, Ben?
I did. Yeah, I did. I did.
Did you notice that was a little bit of a Ennio Morricone sound-alike kind of music?
No way.
I mean, almost egregiously so.
Oh, very much
it
so.
It even had the wee-wee-hoo kind of vibe. It was very, like, clearly, like, even structured, like, in terms of, like, the way the movements of the piece went, very much after the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly soundtrack.
And the way the plot moves is very much a Western. It's a Western that happens to have some space stuff involved. Do you know what I mean?
Lots of dust.
And lots of dust and lots of those tropes. You know, a stranger comes to town. We're righting a wrong. We're teaching the townspeople to fight against these nefarious forces.
Right. I mean, the very first sequence was a showdown in a saloon, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Good call. You know, The Mandalorian is a perfect way to enter today's story because The Mandalorian was one of the reasons, without spoiling this, that's so compelling for a lot of people is that there is this a little bit of genre bending because on paper it's a sci-fi, but in the hearts and minds of the viewers, it's definitely pulling the strings of a Western.
And mainly Baby Yoda. That's mainly why people like the show.
Technically, the child.
The child, that's right. And it's so funny that it's become this Baby Yoda thing. That's a total misnomer. Talk to someone like Holly Fry. She will set you straight.
Mm-hmm.
We hung out with her this weekend, and I mentioned, I asked her how she felt about people referring to it as Baby Yoda. And she goes, nobody knows Yoda's species.
Right. And that's canon. I think that comes from Lucas. If not directly from Lucas, it's been well-established, non-negotiable. No one knows the species to which Yoda, Master Yoda, belongs. There is another example of his species that is canon. And then there's the third, which is referred to as the child in The Mandalorian. So in The Mandalorian, there is this creature that's, you know what? It's kind of like how in TLC, or maybe it was in Discovery, when they did a series on child pageants, which Casey and I had to get involved in editing. You remember that, Casey?
I do remember this. I'm trying to remember the name of the show.
I can't remember the name of the show, but I remember...
I guess it wasn't Honey Boo Boo, was it?
It was. It was the soil from which Honey Boo Boo sprang.
Right, right.
Who used to have a name, but people just loved a statement that this character made so much that it became her name. They would just call her Honey Boo Boo. Now, even though it's technically the child, the studios have kind of acceded to the demand and have allowed it to be called Baby Yoda.
Well, you know, why wouldn't they? I'm really looking forward to that new Baby Yoda plushie from Build-A-Bear. I will be buying one for my daughter and possibly one for myself.
Yeah, I'm probably going to get like a onesie. What are those Japanese...
A Kigurumi?
Yeah, I'm going to get one of those. I'm very excited about the action figures. I enjoy action figures.
It'll only need to, like, have very limited movement, though. It'll only need to have his little hands be able to go up ever so slightly, and his little neck to be able to swivel.
Yeah. I want the deluxe model with, like, 18 unnecessary points of articulation, you know, so, like, the three little fingers can move.
Ninja Turtle fingers.
I'm making Yoda hands.
He is. It's really creeping me out. I want one that comes with that little floating egg. That I want to be fully functional, but that's asking kind of a lot. But we digress. Baby Yoda aside, The Mandalorian is, in fact, a space western and follows a lot of those tropes. It has that whole, like, the town situation where the streets are empty and the lone gunman comes walking into town, and only then do all the bounty hunters emerge, you know, in this case on jetpacks or whatever.
I think the cool thing about The Mandalorian as a Western and as sci-fi is that we all understand it is fictional. It takes place in a fictional universe, right? And as much as we may love these characters, they and the events depicted in the show are not real. It may surprise some of us listening today to know that the concept of the Wild West in general has been greatly exaggerated. The period that we would call the Wild West, the actual Wild West in the United States, is actually a very short span of time. And despite being a short span of time, it captured the national imagination. You know, people wanted to be out on the horizon singing Get Along, Little Doggies. They wanted to rope cattle. They wanted the whole nine, the 10-gallon hat. And it turns out that just living vicariously through the world of film was not quite enough to satisfy the Wild West itch of audience members. And so people began to recreate, to the best of their ability, the scenes they had seen depicted on film. And they also depicted these sort of like a, oh, it's like a reenactment village. You know what I mean? If you've ever been to the Virginias or, you know, one of those like colonial towns where they go, this is how we churn butter. And, you know, we have to burn these people as witches. I'm kidding, hopefully, about that last part. That's a little dark. But all of these things, these tropes, these depictions of fiction, these recreated experiences, they all come to a head in a small town called Palisade, Nevada. Not Palisades, just the one, Palisade, Nevada. Today, there's nothing left. But once upon a time, it used to be a cavalcade of Wild West-themed adventures.
Yes, it's true. Almost like a low-tech West world. Because in the 1870s, Palisade, Nevada, had kind of a rep as being a pretty tough place full of outlaws and bounty hunters and, you know, loose women and the like. And, you know, the place that was prone to stagecoach robberies, shootouts, or even attacks from Indian tribes from the area. But here's the thing. It was actually, like Westworld, a whole bunch of theater, minus the ridiculously advanced AI. But just the same, it did get that reputation. And there were some people that weren't in on the joke, newspaper reporters, for example, who wrote about the place as though it were real, with that whole notion of being a real, you know, rough and tumble place full of tough customers and outlaws, etc.
It's interesting. So Palisade, Nevada, during the age of the railroad, it only had a population of about 300. It was kind of like, it was one of those towns that just sprang up because of the railroad. And it was this isolated kind of rough place, you know. It was named originally, it was named Palisades in the plural, named after the rock cliffs that were the east of town. They were on the banks of the Humboldt River. And according to a publication called The Pacific Tourist, which was a guidebook for people traveling by rail in the late 1800s, the town was halfway down this crazy, wild canyon, and it was largely untraveled, and the upper half of the canyon was so rugged that, quote, not even a horseman venture through it. So this town, even it was founded in 1868. I'm getting a little ahead of myself there. When it was founded, it was just a place to water the steam engines on the Central Pacific Railroad, and it grew into a depot in the 1870s. So it was at one time, it was a real, you know, Wild West town.
That's right. It actually was a pretty popular depot in the 1870s. Elko and Carlin were two other depot stops, and it gave them a run for their money on the Central Pacific line that was for wagon, freight, and stage lines on the way to Mineral Hill, Eureka, and Hamilton. And Palisade was a very big shipping hub, a distro center for sheep and cattle, and also other types of shipments coming from the east and west. And we have a really great account of some of these details on the ElkoDaily.com. And it's interesting. The town was a very resilient little town. It actually survived a pretty serious fire and a flood around 1910. But yeah, I mean, the whole idea behind this place is that it had this reputation. There were reports that there were all of these crazy massacres that were happening on the regular, specifically when the train would pass through. And was this a coincidence? It turns out it wasn't a coincidence, because the residents of Palisade were actually putting on a bit of a show. It was all a bunch of theater for the tourists. They would, you know, league up even with local Native American tribes from the Shoshone tribe, and they would put on these massacres using everything from, you know, blank rounds to gallons of cattle blood to create the illusion that these were real shootouts. So, and the thing that I was confused about and that I was asking about earlier is, do you think that the folks were in on it, the folks who rode by and saw these things? I'm guessing that eventually they maybe were, but it certainly seems that some folks weren't in on the joke, because there were newspaper articles being written left and right about how this place was so rough. But as it turns out, all of these folks were just amateur actors.
That's correct. According to an article in the Eureka Sentinel by Dave Maxwell, it turned out that the vast majority of people who were passing through on the Central Pacific train line had no idea that these robberies and these attacks were staged. Now, we are not sure at this point exactly how these this idea of fake shootouts began, but you'll see some historians saying that a train conductor once talked to a resident of Palisade, Nevada, and said, you know, my passengers love the idea of the Wild West. They read it in dime novels and all this other stuff, and they're kind of disappointed. They're a little deflated when they pass through and it's just a regular town. So what seems to have occurred is that the town people said, oh, you want a Wild West experience? Well, by golly, you're going to have it.
So wait a minute. They were already actors? They just happened to be a town of, like, nascent actors that were looking for an outlet to ply their craft? And it was just a perfect storm where they're like, all of a sudden, okay, now we've got, finally, we've been thirsting to tread the boards, and now here we are with the perfect opportunity. What do you think, Ben? This is all very interesting to me.
It seems like because they're amateurs, it seems like they took inspiration. Maybe there were a few sort of repressed would-be actors, but I think they really began doing this purposefully for the railroad. The townspeople started recruiting amongst themselves. They got railroad workers in on the job, and they even, as you said, got a local community of Native Americans to join in. And for 3 years, they would do these fake gunfights, these attacks. They would use beef blood from the local slaughterhouse. And they were able to pull this off because when these trains pulled into town, they would be bound for places like San Francisco or Chicago. And this is where they would make a stop. So you wouldn't be cramped up in the passenger car all day, of course. You want to get out. You want to walk around, pick up some snacks. And that's when the quote-unquote attacks would occur.
I mean, I guess it's lucky that nobody got hurt, right? I can't get over the Westworld comparison here, because this is like Westworld, but yet this is during the time where supposedly that type of scene existed. And folks might remember, or if not, you should check it out. We did an episode pretty early in the history of the show called The Wild West Was Pretty Dull, or Wasn't Really That Wild at All. And that really does go into show how these super lawless and violent towns were quite largely the product of some fictionalization and fabulism from yellow journalism to actual fictionalized accounts. But this was taking that and pushing it to the next level. I just imagine people kind of getting off and I'm going to San Francisco, gonna get me a little snag. Oops, better step over this bloodied corpse here, and this is all really fun and thrilling. I mean, I just you would think that people would stop wanting to travel through it, but I think they were so thrilled by it that the word of mouth spread, and they're like, "Oh, this is great!" And yet, it's still not clear if everybody knew that it was staged or not.
It's true. From what we can see, quite a few of the passengers had no idea what was happening. We get some of this information from a Nevada historian named Dan Ashball, and Dan follows the order of the typical fake attack or fake robbery. The residents of the town or the railroad workers or the Native American community would wait till all the passengers got off, and then the shooting started. And the only people who fell when they got shot, quote unquote, were the victims. Passengers thought there was straight up an attack, a train robbery. They screamed with terror, according to Dan, at least. They ran for safe spots, and he notes that some people even dove under the train cars, which is a very dangerous place to be. And I don't think, I don't think it was like a haunted house to them. I think they thought they were going to get shot in the head.
I think you're right, Ben. That's the thing that I'm trying to wrap my head around, because this was clearly meant to help bolster tourism, but I don't want to go on vacation to a place where I might get murdered. Do you?
I mean, we're very different people.
Are we?
Yeah.
And I would think in that way we would be mostly aligned.
I've traveled to some weird places. Not on a family trip. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would be fair to take my girlfriend.
Sort of a death wish adventurer you are, huh?
living on the edge. I think Aerosmith said it best. But I consent to do these sorts of things. The people on this train, very importantly, did not.
But my question is, how would this have conceivably helped with tourism?
Yeah, that's the question. Now, this was a boom, make no mistake. Over the span of this, I don't know what you would call it, immersive theater, over the span of this improv everywhere predecessor, over the span of this con, they perpetrated like a 1,000-something fake robberies or attacks. In retrospect, we can laugh at this because not a single passenger, also called a greenhorn or a tenderfoot, and not a single railroad employee was ever injured. It turned out only the local folks were, quote-unquote, injured. Dan Ashbaugh also notes, this is a funny line. He says, "None of the passengers ever seemed to notice that the victims were quickly carried over to Johnson's Saloon, where they miraculously recovered and could watch the last act." The way it's structured makes me think, yeah, there was probably someone with some theater background who was leading the charge on this.
I'm fascinated by the whole thing. I would have loved to witness that, blessed with the knowledge that I was not going to get shot in the face. But, like many good things, I don't know if this was necessarily a good thing. This honestly seemed like a pretty cruel prank to play on these greenhorns, with a term of abuse thrown around in those days for city slickers, folks that don't have the knowledge or experience of life on the range. But, it kind of backs up what I would think would maybe be more of the reason there was a boom in the first place, which was the fact that this was a kind of a depot town and the trains passed through. But when Eureka's mines began to, be depleted around 1885, Palisades started to kind of become a little less relevant. By 1902, the railroad company transferred this property to a new company out of Utah and renamed it the Eureka and Palisade Railway Company. But then, possibly due to some improvements in mining technology, it was several years later, after all, in 1902, Eureka began to experience kind of a renewed interest in its mines. They were going to give it another go, looking for more gold and ores. So by the 1910s, It was kind of experiencing, the whole area was experiencing sort of a reboom, let's say, or a new improvement in its fortunes. And they found quite a big haul of ore every day that was hauled on that railroad line to Palisade, where it was still, you know, had the qualities of a depot, so it was able to be transferred to another rail line, the Southern Pacific Rail Line, and taken to places like Salt Lake City, where it could then be smelted. But remember, I referred to this as a pretty resilient town. I think I might have mischaracterized that, because that actually wasn't necessarily the case when it came to the severe flood and fires that ravaged the place soon after this renewed boom. It wouldn't necessarily recover so well from these. The floods of 1910 caused a lot of damage to the tracks. I never thought about that, Ben. I guess floods, if railroad tracks are, you know, laid in areas that could potentially become muddy, they could kind of shake loose, or they could actually like become damaged, right? Isn't that sort of the idea?
Yeah, because they're built on the ground. So if the ground beneath them erodes, then they have nothing to be moored onto.
So this was a real problem. I mean, there was a lot of damage and erosion caused by the floods. So they weren't really able to kind of continue using it in the way that it had been used in the past. And then we see that in 1912, the property was actually bought by George Whittle and the Eureka Nevada Railway Company. Not quite sure what they were intending to do with it, but then we have a new player entering the game.
Let's introduce a character, John E. Sexton. He is the general manager of the Eureka Nevada Railway Line, and he steers this operation through those difficult, flood-filled, stormy years. When he passes away in 1927, his brother, Charles B. Sexton, becomes the general manager. And they're making it work. They're making it go. They're doing their best. However, it ultimately goes kaput. In September 1938, the little railroad between Eureka and Palisade is abandoned, and the rails are literally pulled up out of that flood-prone ground, and they are sold as scrap to Japan. With the railroad closing down, it turns out that there was no reason for a town to be out here. The railroad was the lifeblood of the entire community. This is something we can see with the creation of the interstate system. You would have towns that existed only because they were valuable stopovers or crossovers for old state roads and things like that. But once you have an I-75 or an I-20 cutting a straight line through the wild, these towns have no more reason to exist.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And that absolutely became the case for Palisade. And it really began to just completely deteriorate over time until there really just wasn't that much left to speak of. Talk about a ghost town. I mean, it really, not only was it abandoned of humans, all of that stuff had been kind of sold for scrap to Japan, like you had said. And it was really, in complete and utter shambles.
Yeah. And one of the next times it made the news, just a year later in 1939, it was because of an unfortunate event. There was a real disaster. A Southern Pacific train named the City of San Francisco derailed nearby, and there were 220 passengers and crew aboard. 24 were killed, 121 were injured. And so Palisade existed still on paper, in the realm of technicalities, in this liminal space, because again, there's not really a reason for people to live there, but there's still government infrastructure, at least that is up until 1961 or 1962, when the Palisade Post Office was officially closed. And oh man, you know you're in trouble when the post office in your town closes. It's like the last school closing.
Dude, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, even like, living here in Georgia, traveling, say, to Athens or some of the more rural places you go through to get there, even like a town that's like a street length long has a post office. That it really is the sign of like the last vestiges of civilization, which is interesting that that's still the case. So fast forward to the present, roughly so, around April of 2005. This town has been in the Sexton family since the 1920s, and it had finally come time for the descendant of that original John and Charles Sexton, who were the general managers and owners of the town back in the day, to unloaded because he wanted to send his daughter to college, and you know, college isn't cheap. So he sold it for what I would consider a pretty reasonable sum. It's about the price you'd pay for a mid-sized home. You know, he sold a whole town for $150,000. This was in the 2000s, so that was I mean, the inflation isn't that insane from 2005 to 2019. So I don't know. We don't have the inflation calculator. I would guess that it would be maybe in the realm of $250,000 in today's dollars, but that's just a guess. But it was actually, you know, the way it's characterized in this article from the San Francisco Gate is, quote, "It was the most money ever paid for nothing that anyone could remember." So, yeah, it was a 135-year-old Nevada ghost town that still existed on paper. But, Ben, surely there's land involved, right? I mean, when they say there's nothing there, but was that, you know, for the area that they could actually redevelop, or no?
So for Sexton, this is a financial decision, but it's an emotionally hefty decision for him as well, because his mother loved the place. John Sexton, the current Sexton, was around 50 years old at the time, but he hadn't been back to Palisade for almost 40 years, 35 years. And, you know, to raise the money for his daughter's tuition, he decided not to do a straight up sale, but to auction the town, because there was a big kind of Wild West themed auction at what was called the Greg Martin Auction House in Salt Lake City on 3rd Street. And to your point about a whole lot of nothing, here's what they had. They had photos that would help people bid on this lot. The town was lot number 2512. And in the auction catalog, you can see photos that show what the winner of the bid will actually get.
It was 160 acres, though. I mean, they got land.
Yes. Yeah. The nothing to which you're referring is a lack of infrastructure, because other than rattlesnakes, tumbleweeds, ooh, Casey, kick in that Wild West music again, half of a rusted car, you know, a washing machine, a cemetery, there was nothing else. You know, there's not a post office, you're not buying like a working water, you know, water treatment plant.
A handful of graves. One of them, a Miss Mary H. Hardy, who died in 1900, and her gravestone read, "Gone but not forgotten," which was a popular epitaph at the time. And, you know, there were also a few historical roadside plaques, and according to this SF Gate article, both used the word decline to describe the place. So that's sort of its place in history, is being a place in decline. That's mostly what it's known for. But I do still stand by $150,000 for, what, 160 acres?
Yeah.
Isn't that not a crazy bad deal?
It all depends on the location. If there is potable water, that definitely brings it up. And, you know, the thing is, the people who are buying this aren't buying it to resurrect it. The bidding came down to three anonymous people who were relaying their bids via telephone, and they were fans of ghost towns. And the bidding actually faltered at $130,000. People dropped out. But whomever bought this anonymously, by the way, wanted to buy the ghost town. They wanted the decline, the emptiness.
What a weird flex. Hey, let me show you my ghost town.
My ghost town collection.
That'd be a weird first date, you know? Take someone to your ghost town and have a romantic picnic lunch in the abandoned cemetery next to the rusted car.
I would love it. I want a ghost town. I feel like that would be a great thing to have, you know?
Now, Ben, here's a question for you, and I tend to agree with you there. Is there a list of ghost towns that people can visit?
There are many lists, yes.
I would love to do that. That would be an interesting little trip. check out some ghost towns.
Yeah, I've been to a few myself. And I would say, depending on where you live, there are more, of course, there are abandoned buildings everywhere, but there are more ghost towns out there than you might think. Just be careful and acknowledge, you know, obey any signs. If you see something that says no trespassing out at the city limits of like Disappearanton or Vanishville or something, whatever your ghost town's called, there might be somebody there. And there are a lot of towns out there with a population of like less than 10 people. So do respect their privacy and their space. And do also remember that Palisade, while it's a ghost town now, was home to some other significant historical events, right?
It's true. President Herbert Hoover had an attempt on his life there in 1932. This is, you know, allegedly, there was an attempted assassination right before his train car. It makes sense because this was very much a place that would, you know, there would be a pass through for a train transporting someone like this. Right before his train would have gone through Palisade, there was an inspector who came across a homeless person by one of the railroad trestles who had sticks of dynamite supposedly intended to blow up the railroad bridge.
Yeah, but the inspectors didn't all agree. There was another inspector who said, hey, that vagabond did not in fact have any dynamite. Long story short, Hoover survived. Pretty cool, right? And here ends the tale of Palisade, Nevada. We'd love to hear some stories about some other ghost towns in your neck of the global woods. We also want to give a shout out to our previous episode on Wild West myths. You want a laundry list, just a couple?
Yeah, we found out a lot about that real early on in the show. The idea that cowboy hats weren't really as much of a thing as they were depicted. And overall, the Wild West just wasn't that wild at all. There was way less violence than popular fiction and culture would lead us to believe.
Far fewer cowboy hats. Bank robberies were not as common as you think, at least not real ones. Okay, the bank robbery at Palisade, pretty regular for a few years, but again, fake.
And it really is popular culture and American cinema and, of course, Italian spaghetti westerns that really created the legacy that we know of the Wild West, which was you know, much exaggerated. Just rewatched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood on a flight yesterday and really, really enjoyed all the depictions of the Spawn movie ranch, which was this like really insane movie set kind of ranch out in the outskirts of Los Angeles where a lot of westerns and television shows were filmed. And it turns out that the first ever feature film was actually a western out of Australia in 1906. And it was called The Story of the Kelly Gang and followed the real life kind of misadventures of Ned Kelly, who was a well-known gangster or, I guess, outlaw. So, you know, it really was something that was kind of cemented by that golden age of Hollywood. If you haven't seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I do recommend it. It's got a lot of interesting tidbits about this kind of period in movie and television history.
I'd also like to give a shout out to my old man, the Colonel himself, who you may remember from a previous episode on States That Never Were. Turns out old Colonel Bolin grew up with a train car that would do the same kind, a very similar thing. You would take a ride on this historic train and you would be subjected to a fake Native American attack. I reached out to him earlier to get the full skinny. If he has the full skinny, I like it.
I like it too.
If he has some insight into these kind of recreations, then I would love to hear it. We'd also love to hear your stories. And you know what? Give the Wild West and the American zeitgeist a tough time if you must. Sure, the Wild West was largely exaggerated, but come on, it gave us so much amazing fiction. It gave us, you know, The Man with No Name. It gave us The Mandalorian. It gave us one of my favorite musicians of all time, Ennio Morricone. I cannot hate it, even if it's fictional.
It gave us Baby Yoda, which is, you know, I would say the greatest gift of all.
And with that, we would like to thank you, as always, for tuning in. Big thanks, of course, to our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Huge thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme, research associate, Gabe Loser, Christopher Hasiotis, here in spirit, and Jonathan Strickland, that notorious and mischievous quister.
Big thanks as well to Eve's Jeffcoat. Check out her show, This Day in History Class, where, spoiler alert, you might hear two of... you'll hear us make an appearance. Act surprised.
If you wish, you can join our Facebook group. We are the Ridiculous Historians. You can check that out. Just name me or Ben as human people, or you know, some other reference will get you in the door easily. You can check us out individually on social media. I am exclusively on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
And you can find me in a burst of creativity at Ben Bolin on Instagram. Tune into that one especially, because there are a couple of weird places I'm going to try to get over the next 2 months. You can also find me on Twitter, where I am at Ben Bolin, HSW. And with that, we say get along, little doggies. I always wondered, were they actually dogs?
Like prairie dogs, maybe?
Maybe.
Ben, you take care of yourself on your adventures, my friend. I worry about you sometimes. I want you to be safe.
And safe travels to you as well, Noel.
Thanks. See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.